the barbaric Aryan peoples who became ultimately the masters of all the ancient civilizations of the Orient and of the Western world, never passed through a phase of temple rule on their way to civilization. They came to civilization late. They found that drama already half played. They took over the ideas of both temple and kingship when those ideas were already elaborately developed from the more civilized Hamitic or Semitic people they conquered. The greater importance of the gods and the priests in the earlier history of the Mesopotamian civilization is very apparent, but gradually the palace won its way until it was at last in a position to struggle definitely for the supreme power. At first, in the story, the palace is ignorant and friendless in the face of the temple. The priests alone read. The priests alone know the people are afraid of them. But in the dissensions of the various cults comes the opportunity of the palace. From other cities, from among captives, from defeated or suppressed religious cults, the palace gets men who also can read and who can do magic things. The court also becomes a center of writing and record. The king thinks for himself and becomes politic. Traders and foreigners drift to the court, and if the king hasn't the full records and the finished scholarship of the priests, he has a wider and fresher first-hand knowledge of many things. The priest comes into the temple when he's very young. He passes many years as a neophyte. The path of learning the clumsy letters of primitive times is slow and toilsome. He becomes erudite and prejudiced rather than a man of the world. Some of the more active-minded young priests may even cast envious eyes at the king's service. There are many complications and variations in this ages-long drama of the struggle going on beneath the outward conflicts of priest and king, between the made man and the born man, between learning and originality, between established knowledge and settled usage on the one hand, and creative will and imagination on the other. It's not always, as we shall find later, the priest who's the conservative and unimaginative antagonist. Sometimes a king struggles against narrow and obstructive priesthoods. Sometimes priesthoods uphold the standards of civilization against savage, egotistical, or reactionary kings. One or two outstanding facts and incidents of the early stages of this fundamental struggle in political affairs are all that we can note here between 4000 BC and the days of Alexander. Fifth, in the early days of Sumeria and Akkadia, the city kings were priests and medicine men rather than kings, and it was only when foreign conquerors sought to establish their hold in relation to existing institutions that the distinction of priest and king became definite. But the god of the priests remained as the real overlord of the land and of priest and king alike. He was the universal landlord. The wealth and authority of his temples and establishments outshone those of the king. Especially was this the case within the city walls. Hammurabi, the founder of the first Babylonian Empire, is one of the earlier monarchs whom we find taking a firm grip upon the affairs of the community. He does it with the utmost politeness to the gods. In an inscription recording his irrigation work in Sumeria and Akkadia, he begins, "When Anu and Bel entrusted me with the rule of Sumer and Akkad," we possess a code of laws made by this same Hammurabi. It's the earliest known code of law, and at the head of this code we see the figure of Hammurabi receiving the law from its nominal promulgator, the god Shamash. An act of great political importance in the conquest of any city was the carrying off of its god to become a subordinate in the temple of its conqueror. This was far more important than the subjugation of king by king. Merodach, the Babylonian Jupiter, was carried off by the Elamites, and Babylon didn't feel independent until its return. But sometimes a conqueror was afraid of the god he had conquered. In the collection of letters addressed to Amenophis III and IV at Tilamana in Egypt, to which allusion has already been made, is one from a certain king, Tushratta, king of Mitanni, who has conquered Assyria and taken the statue of the goddess Ishtar. Apparently he sent this statue into Egypt, partly to acknowledge the overlordship of Amenophis, but partly because he fears her anger, so says Winkler. In the Bible is related in Samuel 1, chapter 5, verse 1, how the Ark of the Covenant of the God of the Hebrews was carried off by the Philistines as a token of conquest into the temple of the fish god Dagon at Ashdod, and how Dagon fell down and was broken, and how the people of Ashdod were smitten with disease. In the latter story, particularly, the gods and priests fill the scene. There's no king in evidence at all. Right through the history of the Babylonian and Assyrian empires, no monarch seems to have felt his tenure of power secure in Babylon until he had taken the hand of Bel, that's to say, that he'd been adopted by the priesthood of Bel as the god's son and representative. As our knowledge of Assyrian and Babylonian history grows clearer, it becomes plainer that the politics of that world, the revolutions, usurpations, changes of dynasty, intrigues with foreign powers, turned largely upon issues between the great wealthy priesthoods and the growing but still inadequate power of the monarchy. The king relied on his army, and this was usually a mercenary army of foreigners, speedily mutinous, if there was no pay or plunder, and easily bribed. We've already noted the name of Sennacherib, the son of Sargon II, among the monarchs of the Assyrian Empire. Sennacherib was involved in a violent quarrel with the priesthood of Babylon. He never took the hand of Bel, and finally struck at that power by destroying altogether the holy part of the city of Babylon in 691 BC, and removing the statue of Bel Marduk to Assyria. He was assassinated by one of his sons, and his successor, Esarhaddon, his son, but not the son who was his assassin, found it expedient to restore Bel Marduk and rebuild his temple, and make his peace with the god. Assurbanipal, in Greek Sardanapalus, the son of this Esarhaddon, is a particularly interesting figure from this point of view of the relationship of priesthood and king. His father's reconciliation with the priests of Bel Marduk went so far that Sardanapalus was given a Babylonian instead of a military Assyrian education. He became a great collector of the clay documents of the past, and his library, which has been unearthed, is now the most precious source of historical material in the world. But for all his learning, he kept his grip on the Assyrian army. He made a temporary conquest of Egypt, suppressed a rebellion in Babylon, and carried out a number of successful expeditions. As we've already told in chapter 14, he was almost the last of the Assyrian monarchs. The Aryan tribes, who knew more of war than of priestcraft, and particularly the Scythians, the Medes, and Persians, had long been pressing upon Assyria from the north and northeast. The Medes and Persians formed an alliance with the nomadic Semitic Chaldeans of the south for the joint undoing of Assyria. Nineveh, the Assyrian capital, fell to these Aryans in 606 BC. 67 years after the taking of Nineveh by the Aryans, which left Babylonia to the Semitic Chaldeans, the last monarch of the Chaldean Empire, the Second Babylonian Empire, Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, was overthrown by Cyrus the Persian. This Nabonidus, again, was a highly educated monarch, who brought far too much intelligence and imagination and not enough of the short-range wisdom of this world to affairs of state. He conducted antiquarian researches, and to his researches it is that we owe the date of 3750 BC assigned to Sargon I and still accepted by many authorities. He was proud of this determination and left inscriptions to record it. It's clear he was a religious innovator. He built and rearranged temples and attempted to centralize religion in Babylon by bringing a number of local gods to the temple of Bel Marduk. No doubt he realized the weakness and disunion of his empire due to these conflicting cults and had some conception of unification in his mind. Events were marching too rapidly for any such development. His innovation had manifestly raised the suspicion and hostility of the priesthood of Bel. They sided with the Persians. The soldiers of Cyrus entered Babylon without fighting.